The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the fourth message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, March 1st, 2025.
We're going to try to move ahead a little bit on this new series entitled Survey of the Books of Samuel, and this is now the fourth message in this new series. And we're not moving very fast, I acknowledge that. I'm going to try to move a little faster, but some of the material, I hate to kind of just pass through it without taking the opportunity, because there's so many good meaty lessons or pieces of history that I think that are very valuable. So while we go through it, I hope you don't mind if we kind of stop and pause and do a little bit of a deep dive on some of these principles. But if you'll recall, last time we were in 1 Samuel chapter 1, and we saw that God answered Hannah's prayer for to be able to have a child. She was given that blessing by God as a miracle. She gave birth to little Samuel. And then when he was weaned, whatever age, 3 years old, 4 years old, five, whatever it was, after he was weaned, she and her husband Elkanah followed through on their vow. Hannah made the vow, but her husband, who had the authority to annul her vow, but he did not, which means now it became his vow as much as hers. They followed through on it and turned their little son over to Eli the high priest during the Feast of Tabernacles. So they fulfilled it. Then we looked and we got into chapter 2, and we got through verses 1 through 10, which covered Hannah's very specific prayer to God of thanksgiving after delivering her son over, as she promised. Instead of being or expressing remorse and resentment over having to follow through and giving up her son, she actually provides this incredible prayer of thanksgiving to God, which then God turned and used by his inspiration to Hannah to turn into a long-range prophecy for the church, which is pretty interesting when you think about it. So we went through that long-range prophecy for the church, which is the first time, as I mentioned to you, where the term used for the Christ or the anointed one is actually used in the Bible. So we saw that. Then we ended with chapter 2, verse 11. So now we're going to pick it up in verse 12. Now we're talking about, and the main topic for today is about apostasy. And that's what we're having described to us, beginning in 1 Samuel 2, verse 12. Now the sons of Eli were sons of Belial. They knew not the Eternal. Okay, now these are the sons. Now Eli's the high priest. He's the one with authority over the tabernacle and the religious activities and the service to the whole nation of Israel. But he's in essence delegated it to these two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. So they're the ones that are actually running things. And God records that these sons, two men were sons of Belial. They knew not the Eternal. Now, what does that mean? Really, they were ignorant? I mean, how could they not know God? They were Israelites, number one. They were Levites, in particular, number two, an entire tribe whose sons were raised to dedicate themselves to the religious service of the whole nation. They weren't the farmers or the ranchers or the vendors. They were the ones who were the ministers on behalf of the entire nation, an entire tribe, a tithe of Israel. That's how God referred to the Levites. They were a tithe of the nation, and they were his. So how was it that they were not? And Eli was sincere. How is it that his two oldest sons then would not have known God? Well, obviously, then we're not talking about a technical training in the commandments of God or the duties or responsibilities of the priest in taking care of the tabernacle. What we're talking about is character, and in this case, the lack thereof. their unwillingness to actually do what was right and what they had been trained to do. Continuing in verse 13, the priest's custom, and this is not talking about now what the priests were supposed to do according to the commandments of God through Moses. We're talking about these two men. These priests' custom with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant came. So they had henchmen. This is the way I read. I'm trying to like read between the lines and figure out kind of what the gist that seemed to be going on in the storyline. So Hophni and Phinehas had henchmen who basically were their enforcers. And they were enforcing on the people who would come with their sacrifices. And we're not just talking, in this case, we're not talking about the example of a burnt offering, which was supposed to be totally consumed, or a sin offering, totally consumed. We're talking about now the thanks offerings or the peace offerings. All right? And the priest's servants came, and while the flesh was in seething with a flesh hook of three teeth in hand, and I get the idea of like, you know, if you ever seen like a fishing lure that's got three different hooks coming off of it, and now it's, let's say it's bigger. It's some big, you know, three-tong thing. Now you put that down in a pot and let it latch onto the meat, and how much are you going to bring out? A lot, if not all of it. While the flesh was in seething with a flesh hook of three teeth in hand, verse 14, and he struck it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot, all that the flesh hook brought up, the priest took for himself. So they did in Shiloh. Okay, well, if you don't know the way it was supposed to work, then you wouldn't know whether this is good or bad or not. So did they in Shiloh unto all the Israelites that came thither. And what really is happening here is that they are robbing the brethren of their property, because these peace offerings were supposed to be shared. A portion went to the priest, but the majority of it went to the family who actually brought the offering. Okay, so just a quick summary. I'm not going to go back and labor through the details of it, but I'll read you one short citation from Adam Clark's commentary, which I think gives you a good background. Adam Clark says, when any man offered sacrifice, that is, when a peace offering was brought, the right shoulder and the breast belonged to the priest. That's what the instructions God gave to Moses said. The fat was burned upon the altar, and the blood was poured at the bottom of the altar. The rest of the flesh, meaning except for the breast and that right shoulder, the rest of the flesh from that animal belonged to the offerer. It's almost as if when they brought to a peace offering and then it was sacrificed by the priest in the cauldron or the pot or whatever, but then the priest got almost like a tithe of the meat. And then the family who brought the offering actually was able legally, by God's instruction, to take the majority of it. That's not what Hophni and Phinehas were doing. Adam Clark finishes by saying, under pretense of taking only their own part, they were actually taking the best of all that they chose and as much as they chose. So it was absolute extortion. Verse 15 tells us even more. Also, before they burned the fat, the priest's servant came and said to the man that sacrificed, give flesh to roast for the priest, for he will not have sodden flesh. So the process apparently for separating the fat from the meat was boiling. And since I'm not a cook and I don't know about kitchen things or whatever, I'll let some of you kind of understand all of this better. But this likewise is documenting an absolute departure from what God commanded to be done. Said to the man that sacrificed, give flesh to roast for the priest, for he will not have sodden flesh of thee, but raw. And if any man said unto him, let them not fail to burn the fat presently, and then take as much as thy soul desired. Meaning, if anybody in this process reminded these priests of what the law said, was supposed to happen. Then he would answer him, "Nay, but thou shalt give it me now, and if not, I will take it by force." That's why I called him henchman. I think this is pretty clear what was going on. It was extortion. They were taking what did not belong them to them, and they were totally violating the principles that God set out for separating the fat from the meat. Verse 17, "Wherefore, because of these practices of these despicable priests, the sin of the young men was very great before the Eternal." This is how God viewed it. "For men abhorred the offering of the Eternal." So what are the factors that are involved in here? When ministers fail to follow God's rules, they not only end up putting themselves in danger with God personally, but because of the office they are holding and are supposed to be carrying out on behalf of the group, when they don't do it and when they misbehave, what happens? It's not just limited to their personal sin, which they have to atone for or account for with God. Because of the job that they're doing, a public service for the church, they end up defiling everyone. They end up causing God's people to become discouraged, resentful, and then the people also break God's laws as well. So, if you had lived back at that time and you were dutifully trying to obey the Ten Commandments and the statutes of the judgment and in the holy day seasons, bringing up your offerings and then having the priests behave this way, knowing it's dead wrong, they're hypocrites, they're extorting what does not belong to them and thumbing their nose at God, what would that do to you? Well, there's some few that may have been zealous for the truth. But the reality is, and especially with carnal people like we're dealing with in ancient Israel, their carnal minds are absolutely affected by it, which means they become discouraged because they're being taken advantage of, and then they start thumbing their nose at the principles of God as well. Which is why God says, "Wherefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Eternal, for men abhorred the offering of the Eternal." It wasn't just their sin before God, it was because they caused a state of apostasy in the minds and the behavior of the Israelites. So it was serious indeed. Let's just look at a couple of other texts. Keep your finger there, but turn to Zechariah 13, verse 7, because it reminded me of another truism, another fact, as Jesus Christ recorded it, because Christ, during his life, in his ministry, actually cited Zechariah 13, 7. "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd," meaning one authorized by God to fulfill an appointment on behalf of the people. "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd and against the man that is my fellow, saith the Eternal of hosts." What happens? What happens when somebody in authority who's supposed to be following the instruction, and is, in this case, following God's instruction, but when he is attacked or neutralized, what is the result? When you neutralize one who is fulfilling the office of the ministry, "Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered." This is what God says happens. "Smite the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered, and I will turn mine hand upon the little ones." So God takes responsibility for it by allowing one of his shepherds to be smitten, neutralized, taken out of the way. God could stop it, but in many cases he has not. And what's the result when that happens? He says, I will turn mine hand upon the little ones. Who suffers? The sheep. "Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered." Now, there's a whole lot. Former members of God's church at large out there, and I call them the Living Room Church of God set, they don't think they need a shepherd. "Oh, Jesus Christ is my shepherd. I'll just obey, I can have my relationship with God. I don't need a ministry." these ministers just cause trouble. And I understand where that sentiment comes from, because in the majority of cases, they do cause trouble, and they have caused trouble. And they have absolutely fulfilled this prophecy. Now, this is a prophecy of the death of Jesus Christ, which is why Christ later stated it in the New Testament. It's nevertheless true for an unfaithful minister. Jeremiah 23, let's read verses 1 through 5, just to confirm that. So I understand why these people say, I'm not going to any organized church. I'll sit at home and obey the commandments. Well, there's a lot of God's commandments that make that impossible, by the way, like the requirement to convoke on Sabbaths and holy days, the commandment to tithe. Tithe to who? Tithe to yourself, just to put it in a separate account? Yeah. None of that works. None of that is a fulfillment of the law, because God set these commandments into an organized structure that requires physical organization of people to come together in order to worship, and there has to be leadership. And when you don't have it, the entire group suffers. So those who think they don't need a ministry humanly, again, I understand why, because you've been bitten and you say never again. Mr. Raymond Cole used to talk about that a lot. It doesn't change the fact that it is the way God designed it to work. And it's the only way it's really going to be blessed. And the ones who suffer, it's the entire church who suffers by the lack of leadership. Jeremiah 23:1, woe be to the pastors that destroy and scatter the sheep of my pasture. These are not wolves. These are not true enemies who crept in who shouldn't be there. These are the appointed pastors who had the right and the authority to act in the name of God to serve the church. And yet they're misbehaving. They're not doing what God told them to do. They're doing the opposite. Woe be to the pastors that destroy and scatter the sheep of my pasture, saith the Eternal. Therefore, thus saith the Eternal God of Israel against the pastors that feed my sheep. You have scattered my flock, he said, and driven them away. How would you like it if you had authority over a farm or over a ranch and you hired a caretaker who's supposed to take care of your animals? And that's what you're paying him to do. And instead of taking care of your animals, he's going out there and opening the gates and running them off. You wouldn't be very happy about that, would you? When they do the opposite of what they agreed to do and what they're supposed to be doing. That's exactly how God views these ministers. You have scattered my flock and driven them away and have not visited them. They haven't served them, haven't helped them, haven't poured themselves out to guide, to direct, or to aid them. Behold, God says, I will visit upon you the evil of your doing, saith the Eternal. They're going to get their comeuppance. Verse 3, and I will gather the remnant of my flock. Here's the good news side of it. As I said from Zechariah 13, God takes responsibility for allowing the shepherd to be smitten. And the scattering happens according to his will, likewise to test every member of the body. But here's the happy ending. I will gather the remnant of my flock out of all countries whither I have driven them. See, again, God takes responsibility, even though it was at the hands of apostate ministers. God takes responsibility for allowing it. I will gather the remnant of my flock out of all the countries whither I have driven them and will bring them again to their folds, meaning back into physical convocations in church organization, the thing that many today hate and think they don't need. God says he's going to bring them back into folds. And they shall be fruitful and increase. And we're talking spiritually, most of all. Verse 4, and I will set up shepherds over them which shall feed them, meaning who are going to do what they're supposed to do. Saith the Eternal. Verse 5, behold, the day comes, saith the Eternal, I will raise unto David a righteous branch, capital B. And obviously we are talking about a prophecy concerning Jesus Christ. The day cometh, saith the Eternal, I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and a king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth. So there's a long-range prophecy concerning the second coming of Jesus Christ, when he not only is our high priest as he is today, but also becomes king, the civil magistrate over the entire earth. Then the people of the earth will have justice. Then they will have a king who actually follows the law, which is a good and a perfect and a glorious law, because it is a law that reflects the very character of God. Isn't that going to be marvelous? If you and I do what we're supposed to do, we're going to be a part of that. Actually, part of the regime under Jesus Christ, administering that kind of justice and that administration to the entire world. But in the meantime, for reason, God allows the leaders to be taken out of the way. Either like Jesus Christ, who was crucified. So he used this Zechariah prophecy actually to denote his death. And yet, it tells us exactly what happens and has happened through human history concerning the misbehavior of chosen servants who won't do their jobs. They not only put themselves in danger of their own future, they absolutely ruin the lives of hundreds and thousands, which is exactly what we experience in the 20th century with God's church. So I understand why there are people who are resentful and now, you know, discouraged. And they sure manifest it. They sure manifest it. But that's got to change. The individuals are going to have to come because God has allowed them to experience to test them. To what extent did you really love the revelation of the truth? Or were you just going along following a man, and then when the man failed, you just threw everything out? Well, then how deep was your faith? Or if you did believe it, but now you have allowed it, your faith to be hijacked because of the misadventure of human beings, will you come to see and make a distinction between the revealed truth of God, which never changes and never goes out of style, regardless of what human beings do with it? And can you make a difference? And can you demonstrate in your lives a love for the things which are eternal? That's why one of the big reasons God allows it to happen. It is a test to force us to either grow or to die spiritually. Thank God he has promised that he is going to send a work in order to redeem his scattered sheep out of every place that they have been scattered. We're still waiting for that. We are living in a dark, dark time right now, still the absolute result of the apostasy which happened in our own day, more than 50 years ago. Back to 1 Samuel 2. So there's the apostasy of the sons of the high priest Eli and their misadventures. Now by comparison, verse 18, but Samuel ministered before the Eternal, being a child, girded with a linen ephod. And it doesn't tell us anything about year by year and how old he was at different stages along in this, but he was certainly very young, and he was growing up right there in Shiloh as a ward of the high priest and learning to do the services that were assigned to him. How might a child have served? So I looked up and said, okay, what did the commentators say about it? Take this with a grain of salt. They don't know. Everybody's guessing. If God did not reveal it in specific, we don't know. There's some surmising that can be done. What would a child be able to do? So here was a summary, which I thought was pretty good, but, you know, just like, again, don't put too much stock in it. First, how about assisting with religious services? Now, remember, Samuel was a Levite, but he was not a Levite of the house of Aaron, meaning he was eligible. He was of the tribe to do the religious service, but he wasn't going to grow up to be a priest. A priest had to come from the children of Aaron. And Samuel's father, Elkanah, did not come through Aaron, okay? He was a Levite. Now, the Levites were the assigned assistants to the priests, all right, from all of the other families in the tribe. So there were a lot of things they could do, including duties at the tabernacle. And I don't know the difference, and maybe with a deep dive study, you could figure out what the line between the priest and the non-priest and how much could the non-priests of the Levites do in the tabernacle. I don't know. I don't think we want to go that far into it. All right. But Samuel, certainly as a Levite, was authorized to take the direction of the priest and do what was assigned to them to do. So assisting in the religious service to a certain extent. This one commentator says Samuel could have helped with minor tasks during religious ceremonies. This might include fetching water, preparing simple offerings, or assisting the priest, Eli and his sons in various ceremonial duties. Cleaning and maintenance. He would likely have been responsible for keeping the tabernacle area clean, which could involve sweeping, tidying up, ensuring the sacred space was maintained in a respectful manner. I think all of these things are valid. I just, I always scoff at anybody who wants to take their presumption and then turn it into a fact when we don't know. Lighting of lamps, okay? Here's another possible thing he could have been assigned to do. One of his duties could have been to help lighting the lamps in the tabernacle as described in the Law of Moses. This would involve trimming the wicks and ensuring that there was oil in the lamps under supervision for each task, learning and observing. I'm absolutely sure this was a key thing that a child in the service of the high priest would have been doing. Much of Samuel's role, this commentator says, would have been educational. He would learn by observing the priests perform their duties, thus gaining an understanding of the religious laws, the rituals, and of the Law of Moses. This included learning prayers, hymns, and the proper handling of the sacred objects. Running errands. As a young servant, Samuel might also have run errands for Eli, such as delivering messages, fetching necessary items from within and around the tabernacle, and assisting again with the other duties. So yeah, you and I could write our own list like this guy has done. So it just gives you an idea that there are a lot, and it was a big operation. When it was done correctly, when the priesthood was fulfilling the law given through Moses concerning the sacrificial system and all of these functions of the tabernacle, there were a lot of jobs. It was a major enterprise in order to accomplish it. So all of the hands on deck would have been valuable. And certainly a young child growing to maturity would have had many opportunities to learn and to grow in providing meaningful service. Back to 1 Samuel 2, verse 19. Moreover, his mother, Samuel's mother, made him a little coat and brought it to him from year to year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. It implies they were only coming once a year. Did she and her husband only see Samuel one time a year? I'm not going to say that. What is certain is that they were coming during the Feast of Tabernacles every fall. Maybe they came, more times than that, like Unleavened Bread, Pentecost, but definitely at the Fall Feast for 8 days. They were definitely there. And this was the time then she made him a new coat. He was growing. So he'd outgrow one, he'd get a new coat for a present during the feast. All right. Verse 20 and 21, we find now they come up to see Samuel, to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife. It appears that Eli was very appreciative of having Samuel in his household. Rather than being just some little imp who was causing him all kind of trouble and was good for nothing, it appears Samuel actually was making himself very valuable and very useful, which means Eli was thankful for the blessing of having him rather than treating it like he was pushed off on him. And Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife and said, "The Eternal give thee seed of this woman for the loan which is lent to the Eternal." And they went unto their own home. So the feast is over and they go back home. But not before Eli literally in his office as a high priest, pronounced a blessing upon Elkanah and Hannah for this gift that they made, which really turned out to be a blessing for Eli. Now, what about the wording here? For the loan which is lent to the Eternal. You can go back and do a word study on it, and I think this is one of the cases where it really doesn't help, because the commentators are all in disagreement on what, you know, this word loan means and what the context. I'll tell you how it strikes me. Why is it called a loan? As if they could have pulled Samuel back? Yeah, technically. But remember this, God made parents responsible for their children. And that responsibility does not go away. You can't just cede your authority or sign off. Now, you can do that legally. You can give up a child, turn them over to the state or adoption or whatever else, and then a human government will say they're not yours anymore. But with God, that is not true. Mother and father always have authority over those little ones. Okay, so the fact that Hannah made this vow to turn him over physically to Eli, and Elkanah seconded that, and it became a binding vow that, well, number one, so it wasn't against God's law for them to do that in this case. It, however, I would say it does not mitigate parental authority overall. Which is why I think, which I think would fit very well here with the idea that they loaned him to Eli. So yes, physically he was a part of the household of Eli, not his parents back home. And he only saw his parents perhaps once, twice, or three times a year. Okay? But I would still say there was still authority of Elkanah and Hannah over their child. And I have a lot of very strong feelings about this whole issue of family authority, and I think it's going to probably come out in my sermon for Pentecost this year. Try to connect in advance how that's going to work, but I'm going to do it. Nevertheless, that, you know, the commentators go all over the map trying to explain this, but that's the one that strikes me the most. On to verse 21. The Eternal visited Hannah. So Eli literally pronounced a blessing upon them for what they did and what a blessing little Samuel has been. And the Eternal visited Hannah so that she conceived. So she was formerly barren and couldn't have any children at all for years. Not only did she have Samuel, the Eternal visited Hannah so that she conceived and bare 3 sons and 2 daughters. So she ended up with 6 children, not just the one out of a special one-time blessing. In this particular case, God granted her 6 children, Samuel being the firstborn. That's quite a blessing. And the child Samuel grew before the Eternal. So God ultimately blessed Hannah greatly for her faith, for her conviction in the real truth, even though he made her wait. And I think that's the lesson for every single one of us. With whatever it is we may be asking God to deliver, we have to be willing to be patient. It wasn't that the story of Abraham and Sarah, or Abram and Sarah at the time? How long? They waited 25 years. And that's a case where God promised he was going to give them a son. And then still made them wait 25 years for it. So this is a factor in the way that God works with his people many times, not just sometimes, not just a few times, but in the greatest majority of things, he teaches us the need and the requirement of patience in order to receive the end result of what it is we're asking. If we're asking for something that's within his will, which is always a caveat. But even if it's within his will, very often he'll still make us wait because there is value in us learning to wait. Because patience is what? A fruit of the Holy Spirit. One of the things we're supposed to be gaining. So here's a classic example. All right, on to verse 22. I'm going to put this under a title, Eli Tries to Control His Sons. doesn't work out very well. Verse 22, now Eli was very old and heard all that his sons did unto all Israel, which means he was not ignorant of what was going on. Eli was very old and he heard all that his sons did unto all Israel. It's not even a word as if in the midst of Israel, it's like what he did to the nation. Again, emphasizing the travesty that took place by the misbehavior of the priests. And heard all that his sons did unto all Israel, and how they lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Well, that's a new one. That wasn't revealed before. I thought it was just this mistreatment, this extortion going on with the meat sacrifices. No, they were literally committing adultery with the women, which is my, remember in chapter 1 when we talked about Eli sitting on his chair as a judge and high priest outside the tabernacle and assumed that Hannah was one of these wanton women that was drunk? Why did he assume it? Because there was a lot of that going on. They had created an environment, literally, to encourage women of ill repute hanging out around the tabernacle. And Hophni and Phinehas were the sponsors. But Eli was letting it happen. He knew. Now I'm going to give credit for the fact it's because God chose to emphasize that he was very old. And in his advanced age, he was in a weakened condition to be able to make things the way he wanted them to be. I would say, was that a legitimate excuse? Well, in the end of the story, which we're not going to get to today, shows God didn't view it as such. But from a physical standpoint, we can understand. We should be able to put ourselves in the shoes of Eli to a certain extent and understand he was up against a very serious difficulty. Because when you have children that grow to become adults and they are not good people, it is difficult, not easy, in order to deal with it. Especially in this case now, they're actually taking on your delegated responsibilities in a very high office of duty under God, and yet they have such evil character. That'd be the worst kind of situation. Now, the answer in the back of the book is God didn't let Eli off the hook. He intended for Eli to fix it. Eli was the high priest. Eli held the office of accountability. You can't push that off and point your finger at someone else. How did that work for Eve and Adam? Adam says, this woman gave me the fruit and I ate it. Didn't get Adam off the hook. Well, this didn't get Eli off the hook either. But he knew this is what they were doing because he heard all the stories. Verse 23, and he said unto them, Eli has a talk with his sons, Hophni and Phinehas. Why do you do such things? Why do you such things? For I hear of your evil dealings by all this people. There were many witnesses who were telling him exactly what was going on. Verse 24, nay, my sons, for it is no good report that I hear. You make the Eternal's people to transgress. Eli correctly called it for what it was. His sons were not only sinning themselves, but causing Israelites to sin. Not only the ones who were involved in sins with him, but again, the dominoes that fall as a result to the misbehavior. Smite the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. And so they were more than not separated from God because of this misbehavior at the top. You make the Eternal's people to transgress. This is coming from the high priest. God inspired these words. Verse 25, if one man sin against another, the judge shall judge him. But if a man sin against the Eternal, who shall entreat for him? Eli is saying, you know, it's one thing for one neighbor to do something bad toward his other neighbor. There's a judicial system and a judge to try and make recompense. But if somebody sins against God, who's going to be an advocate for God? Who's going to stand and defend like an attorney to represent God to get justice? Which is an interesting concept. And my answer is, in the end, God always entreats for himself and brings justice. In other words, God doesn't need an attorney. He doesn't need an advocate speaking for him or running interference for him or somebody with power, a henchman, greater than that of the henchman of Hophni and Phinehas. God can take care of himself. But here's the problem, you see, because human beings very naturally fall in to this corruption because they think there's no one's going to stop them. And if God's not going to strike them down by a lightning bolt, it appears they get away with it. And then you get away with one sin, and then you're emboldened to do more. Oh, well, I'm not supposed to do this. And they say, oh, don't do this. That's wrong. You'll pay. And then you do it, and nothing happens. Oh, maybe it's not so bad after all. So then I do it some more, and I do it some more, and I do it some more. Have you ever done that? Are you doing it in some aspect of your life right now? The sins either that are hidden from you or the ones you know full well, and you still haven't overcome them, you allow them to keep happening because you haven't really suffered a price for it. But rest assured, in the end, God is always going to entreat, quote unquote, for himself and bring justice. No one gets off the hook. Our best bet as the called of God in the New Testament church is to come before God and to truly repent and to come under the shed blood of Jesus Christ so that we have that guilt taken away from us so that we don't have to pay the price. There's your happy ending. What was the end result? The end part of verse 25, notwithstanding, so Eli appealed to his sons. He told them they were being evil. He told them they needed to stop it. Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto the voice of their father, because the Eternal would slay them. Oh, so this is now a prophecy of the way this was going to turn out. God was going to deal with them. We won't see that tonight. We'll probably see that in the next message. But stop, and so the end result is Hophni and Phinehas are going to die because of their egregious disrespect for God and their offices in taking care of the tabernacle. God is going to make them pay, and boy, are they going to pay. But think about this in advance. Had Eli used his authority, which he had under God as high priest, had Eli actually used his authority to remove those sons, no matter how much he loved them, if he had done what was right and he had put God first and he removed them from office because they were absolutely unfit, that would have been a hard decision for a father. But he probably would have saved their lives. The fact that in the storyline, Hophni and Phinehas are going to die, in part because God did exact vengeance, justice, righteous justice upon them for their sins. And Eli, their father, was partially accountable because he didn't stop them from their gross negligence. In refusing to take action because it was too difficult, not only did Israel suffer, and boy, did they as a nation, but those sons would ultimately pay a great price. They would pay with their lives. Verse 26, the happy side of the story, all of this is going on. So we're living in a time of outright apostasy in Israel, misbehavior of the priests in Shiloh. And this is the environment in which little Samuel is growing up. I've never before kind of stopped to think about that. Now, you've got a mentor in the high priest Eli who cares about right things. And yet, he's showing compromise all over the place, day by day, by allowing all of this apostasy to go on, and he doesn't correct it. Let me tell you just a little bit of a tangent. This is exactly the way I look at what happened in our own church history with Mr. Armstrong and his wayward son, Garner Ted Armstrong. Now, Mr. Cole would not speak outwardly about, but hey, we're 50 years down the road here. There is a day when you can look back historically. Most all of these characters, not only Mr. Armstrong, who died in 86, but his son, Garner Ted, who died in 2002, and most of all these patriarchs and the ones who were involved in the apostasy in 1974, they're all dead. They are now historical figures. I do not have a problem with talking about them. The Bible talks about these people by name. And we've got the history in writing to prove what happened. And the fact is, I think Mr. Herbert Armstrong fit the role of Eli very well. A man who is sincere, dedicated to the truth himself, but had lieutenants under him, especially a wayward son who did not love the truth and was liberal to the core and misbehaving, and boy, was that documented, including all of his misbehavior with women. And did that harm the church? You bet it did. And Mr. Armstrong tried to address it and handle it. I think it was 1971 when he literally took his son out of the ministry and put him out on sabbatical leave. Good job. Boy, if he had held to that, things likely would have been very, very different. But guess what? The soft-hearted father in his old age, in his mid-80s, relented within less than a year, and in 1972 brought him back just because the son said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Dad, I promise." And he got rebaptized and the whole nine yards. And so his father brought him back into the Worldwide Church of God, not only at the level he had been as an evangelist, but promoted him to vice president and gave him more authority than he had before. 1972. And what do you think started happening in 1972? You put the wolf back with the sheep. And that was the beginning of the end for the church. Because this is a man who never loved the truth and was looking for an opportunity to change the doctrines of the church according to his own sense of whatever he thought was important against his father. In 1972 is when the doctrinal committee began. Think that was a coincidence? No. What if the father instead, I mean, you know, wisdom's always found in hindsight. I'm not saying I would have made any better choice had I been in Mr. Armstrong's shoes. Having had a faithful wife die of 7 years before, well, in this case, 5 years before, and now having so many liberals around you who are lobbying for doctrinal changes, and you're in your mid-80s, and you're having to really try to stand up against this insidious pressure, who wouldn't get tired? Who wouldn't be inclined to relent and to give in and to make just a few compromises to kind of solve some problems, especially if it's because you're trying to redeem a wayward son with hope that given a little bit more time, he'll finally get his feet down and do what's right for the church. I understand all of that. I get it. So let me turn around and say, we have more details about what happened in our church in the 1970s with Mr. Armstrong and Garner Ted. And if I take all of that, and now I apply it to Eli, I almost have a greater appreciation for Eli. God only cryptically shows in short statements saying he was very old. But what was the ramification of him being very old in that office when you've got not just one, but two sons who are absolute, evil men who have no respect for the laws of God whatsoever? How easy or how hard would it have been to displace them, especially because they had a network? It's like a mafia. They had their network of supporters. So did Garner Ted Armstrong. It's not just easy to set him aside, because I guarantee you within a few months of Garner Ted being out on sabbatical leave, there's even a Time magazine article saying, "Where is Garner Ted Armstrong?" He had been the face of the church. He had been the face of the church on radio and TV. And now all of a sudden, boom, he disappears. And the world noticed. And guess what? The income took a hit. Because Garner Ted, the personality, is bringing in a lot of money. And isn't it interesting that within a few months, some of these same quote-unquote conservative ministers in the Worldwide Church who were anti-Garner Ted and wanted him put out when they saw the effect of the bottom line and it put their own future in jeopardy, their paychecks and everything else, they were lobbying Mr. Armstrong to get him back. He's the cash cow we can't live without. He's the face of the church in radio and TV. Please bring him back. So who knows what was going on with Eli and his sons and how, you know, entrenched was their power over everything that was going on in the service of the tabernacle. I just treated as if they were running a little mafia organization. Now, the truth is, no matter physically what you're up against, we're eventually, one of these days, going to get to the story of David and Goliath. Don't hold your breath for it. But you know the story. And there is the individual with no power, physical strength at all, who goes against an insurmountable obstacle. But with the help and the intervention of God prevails. Now, what if Eli had had the faith to trust God would support him, and no matter how it turned out, to do what's right, even in the face of what appeared to be an entrenched mafia organization run by his sons, and he felt powerless to do anything about it except trying to have a talk with him and tell him, stop being bad. And of course, they ignored their father. They were the ones running things, not the old guy. But what if he had stood up? What if you and I, in whatever our physical circumstances in your life, and you have your own, and I have my own, and when you face one of those scary circumstances where in order to do what you know is right, all you see is bad results. But what if instead you put yourself out there, manifest real faith, and say, no matter what, as Job said, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. I'm going to do what's right no matter if it turns out good for me or not. I will not live when it's in my wheelhouse, my area of responsibility and accountability. I will not allow this to go on. I will do what's right and let the chips fall where they may. Do you think that's the orientation God wants us to have as true Christians? Yeah, I'd say absolutely. So don't look down on Eli. Don't look down on Mr. Armstrong. Again, we have great hope, expectation. Well, Eli, I'm not worried about. You know, he was physical. He wasn't called in the church. He didn't have the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. He's going to come up in the second resurrection. Mr. Armstrong, I think Mr. Cole certainly had hopes that by the time of his death in 1986, he had truly repented for allowing everything happen. And the last writing that he did in July of 1985 to the entire church sure seemed to imply that orientation of mind. So I am optimistic. Whatever it is, that's God's business. But can you and I learn valuable lessons? We should be able to. Not to pass judgment or go tisk-tisk on anybody who made a mistake, but to say, hey, would I have done any better? And how might I do better? Why would I do better? Do I love the truth more? Who says? Have I ever been really tested in it? How do I know I'd have the gumption to go against great odds, to do what's right, and let the chips fall where they may? I hope I would. I have no guarantee. Unless we're doing the hard work day by day to grow closer to God and to ask for the power of Spirit, including the faith and the belief to stand by our convictions and not run away when things are tough. Let's go back to verse 26 again. The child Samuel grew and was in favor both with the eternal and also with men. So there's the happy side of this story. He's growing up in an absolute environment of apostasy. And yet, little Samuel is turning into an important individual, which, as you already know, he does. And so here's this principle, Proverbs 20, verse 11, even a child is known by his doings. If you think you can't even tell anything about the character of someone until they get old enough to become mature, that's not what this says. We all end up generating a reputation. Children have a reputation. Because even as children, we demonstrate our character or lack thereof based upon what we do, especially under pressure, even in our little worlds. There are fruits that start to win out. Now, that doesn't mean, because we are all human and we are all carnal, and little children show their carnality. But there's still a distinction where you can see certain commendable traits in certain young ones. Samuel was one of those who demonstrated certain kind of dependability and an interest in what was true and what was right, which means he, from a very young age, created his own positive reputation among all that he was around in Shiloh. Your children are each born with weaknesses. If, as parents, you love them and thereby you correct them in love, you can actually teach them to overcome their bad habits, whatever they may be. If instead, like Eli, you're too weak to do what's necessary, ultimately your children will suffer and they will have to bear their own guilt before God, but you too are likely to share a part of a responsibility if you didn't do your job as a parent. Now that goes against everything that's taught in this world concerning parenting. I reject that word. It's child rearing. Good old-fashioned child rearing. And with God, it never goes out of style. No matter what your influences are in this world that make you afraid to train your children. As a parent, you have an obligation to do it, or else you're no better than Eli. And how many children with the right kind of guidance? I'm not talking about abuse. No, that's always, oh, if you can't say no, or that's abusive. What a farce. Training your children means you teach them out of bad habits. Boy, it takes wisdom to know how to do it right, and there's a lot of ways to do it wrong. You know, the first part of Ephesians 6 tells you that. But when you do it right, you can actually help your children by grooming them out of bad habits that will harm them incredibly if they take them into adulthood without being checked. In love, to help them, literally, to be better off for themselves in the future. It takes an incredible amount of wisdom, but it is certainly very possible. All right, verse 27, back 1 Samuel 2, verse 27. God sends a prophet to Eli. There came a man of God unto Eli and said unto him, and the commentators want to talk about this man of God. In essence, though, the Hebrew words behind it imply a prophet. And I'm going to say, duh, because what follows is a prophecy of events that are going to happen in the future, which means the man was coming as a prophet to actually, one, give a warning message to Eli concerning past behavior, and then to prophesy futuristically of what's going to happen by God's determination. And all of it came to pass, by the way, as we're going to read in the storyline, which means he was a legitimate prophet, not a, you know, self-proclaimed wannabe. All right. So God sends a prophet. This is how serious it is to God. Everything that's been going on in Shiloh, under the auspices of the office that Eli held, and nothing else was getting through. So God sent him a prophet to give him a warning of what's going to happen. Which means, apparently, it still wasn't too late. Had he relented and changed his approach to the whole thing, the outcome might have been different. That didn't happen. Nevertheless, the warning was here. still in verse 27, thus saith the Eternal. Here's what the prophet tells him by the authority of God. He's speaking in the name of God. So God, in essence, is telling Levi through this man, did I plainly appear unto the house of thy father, referring to Aaron, his ancestor, several generations back? Did I plainly appear unto the house? Do you think I really appeared to Moses and to your ancestor Aaron? Do you think that was real? Do you think it really happened, or do you think it was a fantasy and a fairy tale? Verse 20, when they were in Egypt in Pharaoh's house, that tells you the time. We're talking about Aaron. Verse 28, and did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to offer upon my altar, to burn incense, to wear the ephod before me, the authority of the office of the tabernacle? Do you believe, Eli, God is saying to him, that I really did this work through your ancestor Aaron, and that I assigned him that office? It was a God-assigned office, not something that was created by a man at all. Did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to offer upon my altar incense and to wear the ephod before me? And did I give unto the house of thy father all the offering made by fire of the children of Israel? Meaning, do you believe that I'm the one that gave you a right to a tithe of the offerings that come to the tabernacle from the Israelite families? Do you believe that was real? Verse 29, wherefore kick you at my sacrifice and at my offering? If you believe that was real and true and it came by the authority of the living God, why have you disrespected it so much by what you have permitted, which I have commanded? Wherefore kick you at my sacrifice and at my offering, which I have commanded in my habitation? Yeah, the tabernacle was God's habitation. The nation of Israel was God's people. God was the king over that nation. And here's a magistrate who's fallen out on the job. Wherefore kick you at my sacrifice and at my offering, which I have commanded in my habitation, and honorest thy sons above me. You see what the problem was? When we allow our emotional attachment to physical things, especially to children, which is a great potential weakness, and we allow that to take precedent over doing what God commanded us to do, because it would just be too hard to make... Oh, here's a great condemnation. God says, to make yourselves. He didn't just say to make them fat with the chiefest of all the offerings of Israel, my people. He seems to be including Eli as one of the recipients of the ill-gotten gain. So in one way, he's not doing it. His sons are doing it. And yet God is attributing the loot that they're robbing from the people in the tabernacle is also been enriching Eli. To make yourselves fat with the chiefest of all the offerings of Israel, my people. Verse 30, wherefore the Eternal God of Israel saith, I said indeed that thy house and the house of thy father should walk before me forever. I'll make some comments on that in a minute, but let me read the rest of the passage. But now God is saying, the Eternal saith, be it far from me, for them that honor me I will honor, and they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Behold, the day comes, I will cut off thine arm and the arm of thy father's house, that there shall not be an old man in thine house. There's the pronouncement of God because of this great sin in misappropriation in the office of God before the people. It's a serious, serious thing. It's one of the reasons I didn't want to be a minister. I've told you this many times. I have enough problem just trying to be a Christian as a member of the Church of God, let alone being assigned and ordained an office of responsibility on behalf of the whole people, because I know the majority of them who have been assigned those offices have miserably failed. Well, Mr. Cole didn't let me off the hook, so here I am. But that was my thinking at the time. It's like, I have enough problem, I have enough risk making it into the kingdom, just doing what I'm supposed to do as a lay member, not, you know, counting the extra duties and accountability that comes upon the leaders. Because when they misbehave, as we've already seen, then it's calamitous for all of the church. And this was the pronouncement that God made on Eli and his sons because of that behavior. From Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, here's a short kind of commentary summary, which I thought might be helpful concerning this phrase, "I will cut off thine arm and the arm of thy father's house," by withdrawal of the high priesthood from Eleazar. Okay, so I don't want to go down a rabbit hole, but when God is talking about here, verse 30, "Wherefore the eternal God of Israel said, that the house, thy house and the house of thy father would walk before me forever." But now, in essence, God's saying, but now I'm changing my mind. What's he talking about? The original promise of the priesthood of Aaron, and Aaron had four sons. Now, the first two were struck down by God because they did a lot like Hophni and Phinehas did generations later. You can go and see that in, I think it's Numbers 3, verse 4, where it says those first two sons, who likewise seem to be sharing the duties of the tabernacle under their father, Aaron, they misbehaved, and the only reference we get is because they offered strange fire in the tabernacle. And we don't know exactly what that involves, but I guarantee you they didn't follow the instruction that God gave. And he gave meticulous instructions about the way those offerings and those rituals in the tabernacle were to be handled, including the fire that was a part of the censers, the incense that was put in it, and the way that that was done. Whatever their requirements were, these guys, the oldest sons of Aaron, said, "Nah, we got a better way to do it. That's too much trouble. We can do this and we can do that." God called it offering strange fire and killed him. That's where the third son, Eleazar, comes on. Okay, two more sons. So you've got two remaining sons. Eleazar and, oh, what's the other one's name? Anyway, starts with an I. This one is the ancestor of Eli. But what happened, and you go back and read it in Leviticus and Numbers, what happened was Eleazar's son Phinehas, not the Phinehas, not Eli's son Phinehas. There was a faithful Phinehas, and he was the one who was so zealous for the God that he literally mitigated a curse by driving a stake through an Israelite who had taken a Midianitish wife. And by his zeal to literally kill them with this spear in their tent, then it literally saved the nation. And God made a covenant with Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron, and basically promised that it would be through his children, his family line, that the priesthood of Aaron would go. What the reality is, at this time that we're talking about in 1 Samuel, the high priest wasn't really a descendant of Phinehas from Eleazar. What gives? And the Bible doesn't tell us how it shifted over to the fourth son. Okay? But Eli literally was an ancestor from the fourth son. All right. So what's happening now is the prelude ultimately to God fulfilling his promise to Phinehas. And that's going to take place in the ensuing generation now in the life of David and Solomon. But just giving you, and we'll read that when we get to it later. Okay. But what God is saying here is not that he wasn't going to fulfill. He's not saying I'm reneging on my promise. But God had other options. He didn't need Eli. He didn't need Eli's son Phinehas and Hophni. He wasn't going to be held hostage to these people who disrespected the law. And there's too many ministers of God who think God needs them and they can get away with whatever they want. I much prefer Mr. Raymond Cole's philosophy, which was God can raise up servants from stones. Who am I? I think that's a lot more humble and instructive orientation of mind for a minister, not to start to think that he isn't invincible. Or God is duty bound to back him up, and then God is wringing his hands saying, "Oh, I wish I had a faithful sermon. This is the best I got, so okay." And that's maybe that's what Eli and Hophni and Phinehas thought. God, through this prophet who sent to Eli and said, I'm not going to be held hostage by you. I will absolutely snatch it away from you. And that's exactly what he was going to do. But see, he had another option. Now, there was another son. There was another son of Eli. And the high priesthood, after the death of Hophni and Phinehas, took on the high priest duties. So there wasn't a void. But then ultimately, the grandson, was going to lose it, Abiathar. And guess what? It would be Zadok, who was the actual descendant from Eleazar and Phinehas, who would ultimately take on the high priesthood in the reign of Solomon, which would be the fulfillment of God's promise that it would be the line of Eleazar and Phinehas that would actually hold the priesthood. Anyway, so that's sideline. You can study that yourself. There's a lot of commentary on it besides references to the Bible. But just to try to finish up this last section here, verse 32, continuing the prophet that came to Eli with this message from God, he says, and thou shalt see an enemy, likely better translated a calamity. Thou shalt see a calamity in my habitation. Israel was his habitation. God called the whole nation of Israel his habitation, and the tabernacle in particular in Shiloh. And God is saying, you're going to see a calamity take place. And boy, was that going to be fulfilled. In all the wealth which God shall give Israel, and there shall not be an old man in thine house forever. Now, he didn't say that the line of Eli would be stamped out. There would be descendants of Eli that would survive. But God is saying none of them will get old. They will have children and continue the line, and then they're going to die while they're still young men. Verse 33, and the man of thine whom I shall not cut off from mine altar. So there would be ones of the lineage of Eli who would do service in the tabernacle. But God says, the man of thine whom I shall not cut off from mine altar shall be to consume thine eyes and to grieve thy heart. They weren't going to be good characters who would leave a good legacy. And all the increase of thine house shall die in the flower of their age. Everything they put their hand to is going to turn to dust. Verse 34, and this shall be the sign unto thee that shall come upon thy two sons. Upon Hophni and Phinehas, in one day they shall die, both of them. That's a pretty direct prophecy, without equivocation on the part of God. Verse 35, and I will raise me up a faithful priest that shall do according to that which is in mine heart and in my mind. I'm going to replace your, evil, nefarious sons who won't follow my rules with somebody who will. What a concept, God says. And I will build him a sure house, and he shall walk before mine anointed forever. Ah, that's a long-range prophecy again for Jesus Christ, the final heir, who would be the last great high priest. Verse 36, and it shall come to pass that every one that is left of thine house shall come and crouch to him, meaning to this faithful high priest. The ones who have been unfaithful, they're going to come and beg for a morsel of something good. Shall come and crouch to him for a piece of silver and a morsel of bread, and shall say, put me, I pray thee, into one of the priest's offices that I may eat a piece of bread. Physically, this was going to actually take place during the reign of David and Solomon. But even on a bigger stage, this is the very orientation that's going to happen when Jesus Christ returns. And what do the prophecies say? Every knee is going to bow before him. So the final fulfillment of this is when Christ subdues all families of all nations upon this earth and forces them to submit to him. And they, whether they like it or not, will be begging for a favor to preserve their lives. That's going to be the ultimate fulfillment of this prophecy. So Zadok would be the ultimate one physically within a generation of this prophecy. who would be the priest to fulfill the prophecy during the reign of Solomon. Jesus Christ was the final antitype that matters most. Last text to end this, 1 Chronicles 24, verse 1 and 2, because it makes a statement concerning the lineage here. For 1 Chronicles 24, verse 1, now these are the divisions of the sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. There it is. So Ithamar was the fourth son. All right. But Nadab and Abihu died before their father and had no children because God struck them down. No other details about it. But that you can find in Numbers chapter 3. Therefore, because the oldest two sons got wiped out by God, Eleazar and Ithamar executed the priest's office. So there's a duality. And a lot of times, so is the case with Eleazar and Ithamar sharing under Aaron. And ultimately, after Aaron died, it seemed like there was still kind of a tag team going on. Somehow, it moved away from Eleazar and Phinehas and ended up ensconced with Ithamar. And the commentators just say this likely happened during the days of the judges when things were dark and bleak and a lot of stuff was going on, and God did not choose to tell us how this happened, that Eli became the high priest. There's nothing that tells us the backstory on that. But he was the descendant of Ithamar. But what this prophet has prophesied is that because of their misbehavior in handling the office of high priest and the service of the tabernacle, God was going to wrench it away from Eli and basically the lineage of Ithamar and give it back to that of Eleazar and Phinehas, which he promised Phinehas he was going to do anyway. All right, that brings us to the end. Next time, we're going to carry on and see the remaining of the actual fulfillment of these short-term prophecies as it related to this misadventure in the tabernacle.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the fourth message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, March 1st, 2025.